Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, hymns in honour of the Blessed Trinity. 1950. When Pius XII speaks to a Catholic radio in the United States through the microphones of Vatican Radio. Marking the feast day of St. Aloysius Gonzaga. And when the Vatican mentions Jules Verne, we turn to our popular Latin lover. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by marking the liturgical calendar on a musical note with Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
An old man lay dying. Around his bed were his family and friends. The priest was there too. They were all praying with him as he prepared to pass from this world to the next. Knowing that he would soon meet his Maker, he made his profession of faith in God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Firmly, I believe and truly, God is three and God is one. And I next acknowledge truly manhood taken by the Son.
Those words come from a dramatic poem by Cardinal John Henry Newman, The Dream of Gerontius, and the music is the work of another English Catholic, the composer Sir Edward Elgar. These days, the poem is remembered mainly because of Elgar's musical setting. But when Newman wrote it, in 1865, it made a great impression as literature in its own right. Many people compared it with Dante's Divine Comedy. In well-crafted verse, it describes not only the death of Gerontius, but his journey into the presence of God with his guardian angel and his gentle passage to purgatory. That heartfelt plea of the dying Christian spoke powerfully to people of all denominations in Victorian England. General Gordon, who died in 1884 at the siege of Khartoum, had a copy with him during his last campaign.
I trust and hope most fully in that manhood crucified.
Taken out of their original setting, the verses we've been listening to make a fine hymn in honour of the Blessed Trinity, whose feast we celebrate this Sunday. That profession of faith by the dying Gerontius is essentially the same that we make every Sunday as we give praise and honour to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. There are several different tunes you can use for Newman's hymn, Firmly, I Believe and Truly. I know of at least four. Probably the one best known to Catholic congregations is an old German tune called Omni Die.
Thank you.
Like many hymn tunes, this one has quite a long history. Omni Die Dic Mariae is a hymn text by St. Bernard in praise of Our Lady. We know it better today as Daily, Daily Sing to Mary. Early in the 17th century, a new tune for St. Bernard's hymn was published in Germany. The tune has been simplified a bit over the centuries, but the name Omni Die has stuck. In fact, we sometimes use it for Daily, Daily Sing to Mary, although I think most people today probably associate it more with Firmly I Believe. I was saying earlier that the words of this hymn come from Cardinal Newman's poem The Dream of Gerontius, which Elgar set to music. The first London performance of Elgar's oratorio took place in Westminster Cathedral in June 1903, a fortnight before the death of another great English cardinal, Herbert Vaughan, 3rd Archbishop of Westminster. Vaughan left a great and lasting legacy to the English Catholic community, not least Westminster Cathedral itself. The recording we've just been listening to is sung by the choir of the Cardinal Vaughan Memorial School, founded by the Archbishops of England and Wales some 10 years after Vaughan's death. To hear them singing Newman's fine verse is to be reminded of many different strands in the English Catholic tradition. And to hear what they're singing about is to be reminded of the heart of our Catholic faith. Adoration a be given with and through the angelic host to the God of earth and heaven, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Warm thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And now, to mark the 80th anniversary of Vatican Radio, which falls this year, I'd like to bring you a feature I put together for my series, A Scrapbook in Sound. I'll be taking you back to 1950 with the help of our very own Vatican Radio archives. So get ready to listen to Pius XII in English.
Your Catholic hour, dearly beloved of Christ, began to broadcast its weekly message of faith and fellowship just as the Vatican Radio, which carries to you our cordial anniversary greeting and paternal blessing, was being readied here at Rome for the use of the Pope in his worldwide ministry to souls.
That was the voice of Pope Pius XII speaking in English through the microphones of Vatican Radio to another Catholic radio station right across the Atlantic Ocean. It was 1950 and he spoke to a nation which he himself had become the first pope in history ever to have visited, clearly before his election to the See of Peter. No doubt this broadcast must have brought back memories of that crossing aboard an ocean liner almost 30 years earlier, when he was still Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, the Vatican's Secretary of State, on his way to visit the United States. A month-long stay which ended in New York, where he met informally with the nation's president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, curiously, on the 6th of November, 1936, the day after the American leader's re-election to the presidency. And on his return, this autumn journey may have inspired what seem to us today words of archaic poetic license. Quote, "Our voice on the wings of that marvellous creation of human genius is wafted from the Vatican Hill across the Atlantic, in answer to your desire to hear from us a word that might stimulate the ardour of your missionary zeal." unquote. An archaic poetic license, which also revealed this Roman pontiff's admiration for the marvels of modern science.
When it batted to adjust the voice in the ear to the sensitive drum of a microphone and the loudspeaker to enable human minds really to meet and the human hearts really to beat as one.
Celebrating over a quarter of a century of Catholic broadcasting in the United States provided Pope Pius XII with the opportunity to thank Americans for what he described as a vast treasure dispensed over the airwaves with alertness and unflinching zeal to homes, schools, and churches. But his words did not just highlight good news.
Grace and goodwill, for which family, church and state have been so sorely athirst during this fateful quarter century of wars and rumours of war, of a struggle with the perverse powers of darkness and hate.
Those were, after all, as I mentioned earlier, the 1950s in the aftermath of the Second World War. And the Pope's mind was, as he stressed, bent to the task of keeping hearts always attuned to the single, eternal objective of the Prince of Peace.
Not the cold and the cowering coexistence of the rival neighbours and the nations, but a communion in truth, justice and the crystal love of a brothers under God.
A spirituality, Pope Pius XII pointed out, the sponsors and speakers of the Catholic Hour had been careful to separate from the political.
But for 25 fruitful years, they have rendered you the most pressure of social services, in sharing with you and your children the redemptive message of the living Christ in the full majesty of its human appeal, its healing power, its terrible urgency for a world confused and afflicted before the spectre of a spiritual disaster amid the unfolding marvels of the Lord's great universe of truth and goodness and beauty.
This message to celebrate 25 years of minutes and hours over the airwaves dedicated to Catholics of the United States may have been in English, but it would not have been complete had it not ended in Latin, the official language of the Catholic Church. One obviously familiar to the Pope himself, but also to American churchgoers in those pre-conciliar days.
Et benedictio Dei omnipotentis, Patris, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti, descendat super vos, et maniat semper.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that programme put together to mark the 80th anniversary of Vatican Radio. Moving on to mark the 21st of June, the day the Church remembers St. Aloysius, I'd like you to join me on a visit to a place which is possibly one of Rome's best-kept secrets, there to be discovered behind a heavy curtain in the Church of Sant'Ignazio in the heart of the city, and revealed to me and to you by Professor of Fine Arts, Prida Ennis. So do join us there. We're in a side chapel that's locked up most of the time, in which Prida is going to talk to us about the model of an existing altar inside the church itself.
Literally, we're in a chapel, which is something that's left from a church that was demolished, there is a tiny side chapel, which is the only little chapel remaining from the original Church of the Annunciation, which belonged to the Jesuit College right here behind the Collegio Romano. So
this is the first chapel in this building?
Yes.
And
yes.
No one gets to see it?
Well, yes, mainly because I think it doesn't present itself totally as a finished church now because it's been chopped in two. Andrea Pozzo, Jesuit brother, famous painter, did some trompe l'oeil painting. He was famous for his trompe l'oeil style of painting, as you can see here. Now, this is a tiny little altar, which is almost like a part of the original design of the big altar that's outside in the church, dedicated to St. Luigi Gonzaga, the patron saint of students.
Better known to us as St. Aloysius.
Aloysius, in fact. I get so used to him with the name of the Gonzaga. He was a student in the Roman College, or the Collegio Romano.
Collegio Romano being a huge architectural complex within which both this chapel and the Church of St. Ignatius stand. You were saying about St. Aloysius?
He died very, very young because he was helping the sick, and he got sick himself, unfortunately. He was first buried in this little chapel. He was buried in the floor. And then they had serious flooding in this church, and he was moved to the wall. And eventually, when they built the big Sant' Ignazio, he was moved into his place of glory on the altar dedicated to his name. But what's curious about this is people don't know that inside here is the tiny model. Well, tiny, not so tiny, but compared to what's outside in the church. It's a small model of the high relief. Now, it's more than just a bas relief. It's a relief where you have a figure that's really seriously coming out of the wall. It's a sort of half a total sculpture and half a bas relief, so it's in between the two. But we'll talk a little bit more about that later when we go and look at the actual altar itself.
It's actually in white plaster.
Yes, stucco, white stucco. And then you see, for example, those twisting spiral columns where Pozzo painted here. He painted this chapel. He painted them in trompe l'oeil, so it's just...
We have a stucco sculpture surrounded by Del Pozzo trompe l'oeil paintings of little green and twisty columns.
Yeah, and these columns
are a lot of red and ochre around it. So it's like the stucco has been put into a sort of frame, as it were.
Yes, yes. Taking the place of the altar painting. So instead of being an altar painting, it's an altar sculpture. But again, a lovely play of dark and light, because wherever the light happens to fall, you'll find the little shades. So the whole thing seems to be alive with movement. And what's curious to see is Pozzo painting these spiral columns each side, which are repeated in real terms, like real columns, spiral columns, out in main church of Sant'Ignazio. Except also here, the vine leaves, you can see the vine leaves are painted on. Outside, they're in metal. So it's a secret. I think it's the most secret little chapel in Rome, for me personally. When I first saw it, I remember being deeply affected by it, because you get the smell of mustiness, you get the feel of what it must have been like here, also in the past when this area was flooded many times.
And but despite this being the model, it belongs to the same period as the main
church. Oh, yes. Well, Baroque and Jesuits go together, you know.
They're hand in hand, so
the inventors. And also, this, if you consider this church itself, and okay, we're in the tiny chapel that remains, was built by the students of the Roman College and their professors. During the summer holidays, they all helped physically to build this church. They actually got down on their hands and knees, but also the students and the priests from the college used to come down so late in the evening to pray in this old church of the Annunciata, in this little tiny chapel that has remained.
And a big thank you there to Breda Ennis, a professor of fine arts, who's currently teaching at the American University of Rome. Finally, a word of warning as I get ready to jolt you into a world of linguistic wonder with our Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, whom I bully into departing from speaking about his favourite writings, those of Pius II, who was born 5 centuries ago this year, to tackle that more popular French author, Jules Verne, who died a mere century ago, and whose writings were made into film by Walter Disney. One of the writers that has something in common with Pius II is Jules Verne.
Oh, Lord. What does he have in common with Pius
well,
II?
Well, you know, centuries.
Well, yeah, okay. I was up near his house, and I read all about Pienza and everything, Rosolino and the cathedral and everything. Those were the days. I have a collection of some of the things, and when he screeched at people.
How do you say screech in Latin? Screeching away?
No, exprobrare. When he used exprobrabat. And he told a few cardinals to get out. This is all in Latin.
Do you think he has anything in common with Jules Verne?
Well, I don't know that much about Jules Verne. I mean, okay, 70,000 things out of the sea.
Well, not exactly 70, but...
Anyway, whatever it is. No, Pius II is always precious. He's a great man.
Okay, if I read then, Jules Verne was a man of letters, a traveller and a writer with lively imagination.
Mm.
I'm reading from Cardinal Sodano's message for pastoral care of migrants and itinerant people, which had this theme, travel and transportation from the imaginary world of Jules Verne to the reality of the 21st century. So do you think that Jules Verne could have written in Latin?
Well, he could have, and you'd see the Latin would be much more concrete than a lot of this talk.
How do you say incredible journey?
Iter incredibile.
Crossing the limits imposed. I'm quoting here from Cardinal Sodano's message. Back in 2005, Jules Verne crossed the limits imposed by the dominant culture of his time and its vision of the European West as the be-all and end-all.
Oh, no. That's hard to say. Yeah, someone else wrote that. Jules Verne crossed them. Transgressor says... Fines, ba cultura sui temporis, dominatrice, impositos, and its vision, eius prospectum occidentalis europei, tamquam, be all and end all, tamquam rerum summe et maxime.
Anyway, I found out a few things about Jules Verne. You said it was, I don't know how many leagues under the sea, but it was actually 20,000 leagues under the sea, in which Verne introduced one of the forefathers of modern superheroes. I'm not quoting from Cardinal Sodano any longer.
Heroes. Supremi heroes. There you are.
Misanthropic Captain Nemo. How would you say that?
Misanthropic. Ooh, est hominum ozor. A hater of humans.
And his elaborate submarine Nautilus. You don't have to translate that, do you?
Well, that's just about all Latin. Okay.
And his elaborate submarine?
Yeah, you'd say navis submaria. Cui nomen Nautilus is, of course, Latin Greek.
Okay, well, the film version of that was produced by Walt Disney.
Taculum ilius... Narrationes cinematographeum, Valtero Disney est effectum.
Valtero Disney?
Well, Walter, more or less. Walt, I imagine, is Walter.
It won an Oscar for its special effects.
In those days, yeah.
Yeah, how do you say that?
Suo peculiarium. What are you going to say? Bam, spectacular momenta, huh? Premium a consecutum est Ansgarii of Oscar.
Which included Bob Mattie's mechanically operated giant squid.
Oh, Lord, spare us. Effecta, quaetiam includebant illo tempore, ingentem, what do you say, a squid, my lord? Ingens cete, mechanica
Octopus.
arte actum, driven by mechanical art.
What's a giant squid then?
I said just a giant, kind of like a whale or something. I shouldn't know the name for a squid, but...
It's an octopus sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It fought with the actors in a special studio tank.
That's all right. Cum histrionibus pugnabat, peculiari in... Vase Apud Studium.
It had 44 cameo stars.
What's that?
Actors, like stars.
Stars are
cameo
star.
Must be a Latin word, no?
Well, cameo, certainly, certainly. Innumerabat quadraginta quattuor histriones prestantes. Those are cameo stars.
And then, apparently, the Baron at one point was quoted to have, was heard to have said that, you know, when he wrote about exotic places and he led an uneventful bourgeois life. How does one say that? An uneventful bourgeois.
How are you going to say that? Dux et vitam sine eventibus et in maxima luxuria.
But in 1867, he travelled to Rome and he met with Pope Leo XIII, who blessed his books.
Oh, my.
I told you something you didn't know, right?
I didn't know that. Oh, my.
So how do you say Pope Leo XIII blessed?
So there you go. Pontifex Leo Decimus Tertius. Eius benedixit libris.
Just one last thing. I said that he wrote about exotic places despite his bourgeois life. In fact, his only balloon flight lasted 24 minutes. How do you say his only balloon flight lasted 24 minutes?
Unicum iter, factum inflato folle. Viginti quattuor temporis momentis momenta perduravit.
And in a letter to someone called Hetzel, he confessed to, I'm quoting from it, and this is a line which actually has some Latin in it. He said, I must be slightly off my head, full stop. So how do you say that?
Deveo aliquantum demente abire.
That's where we get dementia from.
Yeah, huh? Certainly.
I get caught up in all the extraordinary adventures of my heroes. So?
Ergo rapior omninum singularibus heroum meorum eventibus.
And then he says something in Latin. He says, I regret only one thing, not being able to accompany them, quote, pedibus cum jambis.
Pedibus cum
jambis.
Jambis.
I think it comes from the jambe in French. Maybe he's using the French.
Yeah, jambis is not
so
Latin.
So it's not really Latin.
No. It's with my...
with my feet and legs, because jambe in French
is... pedibus cum jambis.
It's curious how people used deformed Latin in those days.
Well, I mean, everyone knew everything. I mean, educated people could... pick up all kinds of nice things, which we can't do today. You can't tell clerics jokes anymore in Latin from the Bible.
And heartfelt thanks there go to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who's now in the United States, but spent almost all of his life as papal Latinist. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.